England's director of cricket, Ashley Giles, says he is unconcerned at claims England were given an extra run in their World Cup win over New Zealand. This comes after retired Australian umpire Simon Torfell, who was named the International Cricket Council's Umpire of the Year on five successive occasions from 2004 to 2008, said the decision to award England six for overthrows after a ball hit Ben Stokes while he was trying to make his ground was an incorrect decision. Joining us now is sports reporter for One News New Zealand, Guy Hevel. Morning, Guy.
Yeah, morning, boys. How are you?
Morning. Yeah, we're good. Hope you're well, too. Quite an interesting subject, this, and it's only really got minimal column inches over here. Not many people have focused on it too much, but obviously a couple of umpires now have come out and said that it should only have been five runs, not six. Are you feeling particularly aggrieved about this?
No, not really. Look, at the time, it was one of those things where I was absolutely gutted that that was the way that England essentially got themselves back into the match. But I think when you look at it, Stokes didn't do anything deliberately. It was just a complete and utter stroke of luck or bad luck, whatever side of the fence you sit on. Look, the thing that bugs me the most is that the whole thing was decided on boundaries. That's the one for me that is the most puzzling. But I do find it amusing that somehow there's been something that people are complaining about and finding an issue with the umpires that possibly decided this match.
Yeah, it does look a little bit like they tried to do everything they possibly could to make sure England won the World Cup in England, doesn't it really? Like, okay, we're not gonna give that. I mean, we're just going to say that six runs, not five. I mean, what's one run between friends in the final over, you know? And then obviously we go, yeah, okay, so scores are tied now. We could do it off, I don't know, run rate, just general overall performance at this particular competition. Wickets, perhaps. No. What have England done better than the Kiwis with it? More boundaries. We're doing it on boundaries, lads. Fantastic. Is there a lot of bitterness from a lot of New Zealand supporters, cricket fans now?
No, there's not bitterness. Look, I think most people were probably stunned that the Black Caps made the final. I predicted them to win the whole thing, so I was quite happy that they made the final. But no one else really gave them a chance. Semi-finals was all that anyone was really expecting, and the fact that they made the final, everyone was pretty happy about that. Look, people were disappointed, obviously, when they didn't quite get it done and when they were oh so close, and particularly when England needed 15 off four balls and then, what was it, 9 off 3, I think it was, or something similar to that. And I think that's where the disappointment came for most Kiwis, but there's absolutely no bitterness towards England. There's no bitterness towards the Black Caps team. Everyone's, from what I've read and seen anyway, is actually quite proud. And interestingly enough, when we were hanging around at the team hotel the other night waiting for the Black Caps to get back, I ran into a good friend of mine who's relatively close to the team. And he said that one of the Black Caps players had told him that Ben Stokes had actually asked the umpires to take those runs back from the overthrows, but they said they couldn't because it's in the rule book. And, you know, here we are talking about England winning their first Cricket World Cup.
So Ben Stokes, what, was overheard by some of the New Zealand cricket team asking the umpire to take the runs back?
Yeah, I don't know how much he pushed it, but I think he was just so, you know, he felt like that's a pretty harsh way for them to get those crucial runs. And yeah, that was what I was told the other night, that Stokes actually said to them, is there any way that, you know, we can take those runs back? I don't know if he said it in those words or if it was just a matter of, is that really how I get those runs, but that's what I was told the other night.
What was the general reaction to the game? Because we spoke about it a lot here yesterday on the show. Again, we're talking about it today because it was, for us, you know, the amount of individual moments in that game. I gave the example yesterday that if you were to pitch an idea for a film, you know, you were to go to Hollywood and say, right, we're going to create a film and this is how it ends, they would turn it down because it was that unbelievable what happened in those last few overs.
Well, that's sport, isn't it? That's the beauty of sport. We have just witnessed, you know, and the general feeling back home in New Zealand is, despite the fact that the Black Caps didn't win, the feeling is that it is the greatest one-day international, possibly the greatest cricket game, full stop, of all time.
Yeah.
It was absolutely unbelievable what we saw. How many twists and turns, you know, can you possibly get twice tied? And then just the way it finished as well, not only in the super over, but also in regulation when England were pushing for two and got run out, and it went to the super over. And then essentially the same thing happened when New Zealand were pushing for two to try and win the game. And it was a match that ended and was decided by literally 1.5 metres. And for a game of cricket to go 102 overs and finish with that margin, I don't think there's any Kiwis who can really complain about it. It was just an absolutely phenomenal game of cricket, and I was lucky enough to be there, and it's something that I'll remember for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I just think it was stunning. It was a proper kind of where were you when that was happening moment, wasn't it? And I think it was phenomenal. Kane Williamson, your captain, I thought his field placements throughout the tournament, but especially in the final, were absolutely spot on. England just couldn't seem to find the boundary as much. Obviously, we did end up finding it more than New Zealand, because that's why we won the game. But, we did manage to... we were struggling for quite a while. He was named player of the tournament. He's obviously a sensational batsman. What's the kind of feeling about him in New Zealand? Do you see him as being the hope for really carrying this team forward now and kicking on?
Yeah, he's a superstar. And he has already been labelled as our greatest ever batsman, despite the fact he hasn't quite passed Martin Crowe yet. But, he copped a bit of stick. He copped a bit of stick throughout this tournament for the way that he captained the team in some of the games and some of the fielding strategies that he had and some of the bowling tactics that he used. Some of the bowling selections that he used as well. But boy, oh boy, in the last two games, the one against India in the semi-final, and then particularly the final, as you say, where he seems to just be making the right calls all over the show. And it was nothing that he did wrong. It was really not a lot that the Black Caps did wrong. It was all, as I said before, a string of luck for England and a bit of bad luck for New Zealand that really, I think, decided that game. And I've seen more from non-New Zealanders saying how much they respect and love Kane Williamson before this tournament. Kiwis obviously love him, but around the world he is praised as a superstar. But now I think Kiwis are really starting to realise, what we've got.
Yeah, brilliant. Great stuff. Guy, as always, thank you very much. That's Guy Heveld there, sports reporter for One News New Zealand. Do you know what I found? I obviously spoke to Guy now several times. Is very level-headed, whereas, I'm not going to lie, we won. We boasted just a little bit. We were quite excited about the victory. Whereas, talk about being like good in defeat. Like, a lot of people, if it was the other way around, for instance, and we'd have been on the end of that decision, 6 runs instead of 5, and a couple of the other things that went against New Zealand, there could have been a little bit of bitterness.
I'd have nuked Christchurch by now.
Yes, exactly.
Mm. Yeah, there'd be war. Well, it wouldn't. It'd be over.
There just wouldn't be New Zealand.
New Zealand would be just like a smattering of pebbles in the ocean by now.
When they have the map, they'd have just tippexed out New Zealand.
Exactly. The island formerly known as New Zealand.
Yes.
You know, like Prince.
So credit to Guy, because he hasn't nuked us.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And
Not yet, anyway.
There's been no whiff of any nuking.
No.
So far, which is good. I think, fair play to him. But, we talk about lazy national stereotypes quite a lot and serve them up, actually.
We enjoy them.
We do. We found once we did a Twitter appeal, actually, for some. But with the Kiwis, it's basically just like, oh, you're good fun and nice.
Yeah.
Which I like. It's like in Canada, it's like, oh, you're polite.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Fantastic. Love sports. Last World Breakfast with me, Richard Lee and Patrick Christie's. Now, young people will be barred from serving in the armed forces if they sleepwalk after the age of 13, Defence Minister rules. Defence Minister Tobias Elwood revealed his ruling on banning sleepwalkers. He said, sleepwalking poses risk of injury to personnel within the environment. Royal Navy banned sleepwalkers for at least 30 years and dismissed 8 over the past 3 years. Joining us now is independent sleep expert Dr. Neil Stanley. Good morning, Dr. Neil.
Good morning.
Slightly interesting subject. This is a little bit different for us here on the radio show. But what is the problem with people sleepwalking?
Well, the problem with people sleepwalking is that they're actually carrying out, shall we say, a routine behaviour, which if they're in their own home, like getting up and going to the fridge, getting a pint of milk. If they're in their own home, they could probably do that safely. But if they're on a Royal Navy vessel, they would probably sort of put themselves in some danger. And, each year we have stories, of a sleepwalker on holiday who walks through the plate glass window and over the balcony and causes themselves injury and that sort of thing. So it's definitely a problem for something like a Royal Navy vessel. Although I'm not sure what the issue with with soldiers is meant to be, and why this will needs to have been made in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I mean, potentially you could think if they were out on some kind of operation, you know, and they had to, in somewhere like Afghanistan or whatever, and they had to sleep out one night, you don't want them wandering into the Taliban's clutches, I suppose, do you? But why do people sleepwalk? What goes on?
Well, what goes on is essentially when you're deeply asleep, when you're in the deepest part of sleep, your brain is not fully asleep. The conscious part of the brain is asleep, the bit that allows you to have awareness of the world. But other parts of the brain can wake up. And if they do wake up, they can carry out the behaviour they're tasked to do. And most commonly, it's either the bit that helps you walk or the bit that helps you talk. So often sleep talking and sleep walking occur together. And then what you will do is you will carry out, as I say, a routine task. And if you did it at midday, fully clothed would not be of any interest. But the fact you're doing it at midnight in your pyjamas causes interest. And so a chronic sleepwalker will always sleep at home and make the environment safe. So, you know, there aren't going to be hidden hazards. But when you do travel, that's when it can be problematical for a sleepwalker. Because, they're going where they think they should be going, and that could be anywhere in their new environment.
Yeah, of course. I want to ask you maybe a couple more basic questions about sleep. I know there's information about the government due to give guidelines of sorts, I believe, in the next week or two in terms of what we should sleep. What's your thoughts on that? Because I've heard of different people over the years that have been famous for only having 3 or 4 hours sleep a night and yet seemingly have more energy than anybody. And then other people that are saying, no, you need 8 hours a night. That is the amount of sleep you need. Is there any right or wrong when it comes to sleep?
No, not in terms of hours. Essentially, the amount of sleep any individual needs is the amount that allows them to feel awake and alert and focused during the day. If you feel like that, then you've had enough sleep, regardless of how many hours. So the government saying, thou shalt have, is just going to lead people to anxiety. I mean, we've had the advice about sleep hours for 500 years. A French author in 1514 said we need between 6 and 9 hours. And that's exactly what the American Academy of Sleep Medicine said in their expert consensus very recently. So we all roughly know how much sleep we could get, but it's very, very individual. And as I say, if you say to everybody, you know, you have to have this, and people are going to go to their doctor and say, I'm failing, or, you know, they're anxious because they're not getting the government-prescribed sleep. So I think government really needs to step away. And I think probably we have vastly more important things yes. for government ministers to be talking about.
Yeah, I heard a different strategy, actually, of people that go, it's almost like every 4 hours they'll have a half an hour nap. And apparently, I don't know if this is true, but Cristiano Ronaldo apparently adopts this sleep strategy. Is there any risk to something like that? Because surely if you're only having half an hour's nap, you're never getting into deep, deep sleep?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something called polyphasic napping. And it's something that people do until they get a girlfriend. One of the things is called the Uberman schedule, which just shows you it's the sort of thing that stupid people do until they find a girlfriend.
Is that right? I haven't even heard the expression Uber. What's it called? Uber?
Uberman. The Uberman sleep schedule, which is pretty much what you're describing.
Really?
And then say it's something that, as I say, people do when they're young. They last about 6 weeks and then they go back to normality.
Is that right? Oh, do you know what? Fascinating. Well, look, Dr. Neil, thank you very much. That's Dr. Neil Stanley there, independent sleep expert, giving some important advice. I am fascinated by this, especially because we obviously do this breakfast show. Mm. We're waking up at, I don't know about you, but I'm 4 a.m.
Yep.
My alarm goes off. And naturally, it's quite difficult to get to sleep, say, for 9 o'clock at night in order to get the 7 hours sleep. So ordinarily, I'm going to sleep at 10:30, 11 o'clock. So you never quite get enough sleep, it feels.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's it. And, you know, especially if you've got a partner that snores like a rutting hog. but you sleepwalk, don't you, Red?
I do. I don't know if I do now because who would tell me? But when I was younger, I did, and quite badly. So I watched Jurassic Park when I was younger, and my parents then woke me up while I was running up and down the landing shouting, the dinosaurs are chasing me.
I have a very good friend of mine who does sleepwalk quite a lot, and he woke himself up trying to flush the corridor wall in a travel lodge in Paris.
Ah, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. But no, I think I've been okay. Do you sleep talk?
Yeah, I have been known to say some quite fruity things.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't remember any of this stuff, but I have apparently said things, like, had full-blown conversations with my girlfriend and not remember, but it's got to a point where, like, will it be about a minute into the conversation and I'll just start referencing the peacocks and she'll realise, okay, he's unconscious.
He's talking nonsense.
Yeah.
The thing is, it must be quite difficult with you.
To tell.
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
I mean, like, look, there's every chance we'll talk peacocks in the next couple of hours.
Well, fingers crossed, mate. I'm actually going to bring one in. he's going to get him to do the news.
It'd really liven things up. Do it when Paris is in here. I think Paris would appreciate that.
This is Love Sport.
We're going to be talking a little bit of Arsenal very shortly, Patrick. They had a really good win yesterday. Not that pre-season friendly is much to go by, but they played the MLS team, the Colorado Rapids. They won 3-0. So the pre-season seems to be going reasonably well. However, there is some unrest. 16 prominent Arsenal supporters, groups and bloggers have signed a letter calling on owner Stan Kroenke to reinvigorate the Premier League club. The two-page document accuses the passive, absent Kroenke of using the Gunners as an investment vehicle. Joining us now is Dave Seeger from gunnerstown.com. Morning, Dave.
Morning, guys. How are you?
Yeah, yeah, good. Thanks. Hope you're well too. Of course, host of the Arsenal Fan Show on Love Sport as well. What are you looking to hope to achieve with this letter?
I think what this really represents is the first time that we've seen, there's lots of campaigning Arsenal the last few years for various things, obviously with Wenger leaving and Kroenke out perhaps in the past, but this is more measured and this is trying to get as many people involved as possible, and it's a more passive approach. What we're asking the ownership to do is really take a more active interest in our club and get more involved and really push for more accountability. We've seen a lot of changes in management structure, you know, player contracts not being, you know, organised properly, good players leaving on a free. The club's just been badly managed, and we just want the guy to take a more active interest and care about the club as much as the fan groups do. And this is the first time we've got everyone together. Well, we got a lot of fan groups together to start it. The whole thing was secret. It was launched at 8:45 yesterday morning. Nobody knew it was coming. And then within 24 hours, as I looked this morning, the petition that we launched only just before lunchtime yesterday has got 85,000 signatures. Oof. So fairly substantial momentum gained in the fan base. And that's not just UK, that's across the globe.
Yeah, it is one of the main issues, Arsenal's kind of forays into the transfer market, when you look at, if rumours are to be believed, they're putting in a, or have put in a bid of around £45 million for Wilfried Zaha. You obviously have a look around now and you think, well, I'm not being funny, but if Harry Maguire is going to go for 80, Wilfried Zaha's probably worth a little bit more than 45. That's the
not
tin.
Every club's as stupid as Man United.
No, I know, it's true. It's true, though. No, that is, you can't get around that, unfortunately. But you know what I mean? Maybe Arsenal's frame of reference in the transfer market has been a little bit off. Has the transfer situation been a bit of a turning point for you, do you think, in doing this?
No, it's not. It's not behind that at all. It might be the tip of the iceberg, but it goes a lot deeper than that. I mean, we are a club, unfortunately, we're a club that was set up, and our wage structure and, you know, our staffing, everything's set up for Champions League football, and we're entering our third year without it. So we are, you know, we are not in a financially stable situation, because we are, you know, on a business model that is self-sustainable. And I don't think, I personally, and I know a lot of other people in the group, don't have an issue with the fact that we're not having him as a sugar daddy. No one's asking for that. What we just need is the club to be better run. If we'd been better run over the last few years and he was asking the team responsible that he put in place to be accountable for the decisions they make, then, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation. You know, we could, if we were managed properly, our finances wouldn't be in the state they're in. I mean, you know, Ivan Gazidis, who was responsible for a lot of this, you know, he was being paid bonuses for poor performance. You know, that's not proper management of a large organisation.
Yeah, well, I mean, so is there a sense that the owners essentially are just using this club as, you know, they own the club, but actually realistically they're just using it to kind of line their own pockets? They don't actually care about results. They don't actually care about the fans. They don't actually care about trophies.
Well, they've said they have in the past, and it started to sort of seem that maybe they did. I mean, Josh Kroenke was getting more involved, Stan's son, he was coming over, and then that seemed to die away a bit. So at the moment, yes, we are a business model that is based around making a profit and not much else. That said, things can change. You know, if he looks 300 miles up the M1 or up the M6, look at Liverpool, they haven't put a huge amount of money, Fenway Sports, into Liverpool. They've just managed the club very, very, very well. And they have a strong connection between the ownership, you know, the management structure, the players and the fan base. There is a bond there. And you can see it in the same way that you saw how much Abramovich cares every time Chelsea succeed on the pitch. It's that connection that the Arsenal fans don't have with the ownership. And that can change. Let's hope that will change, because ultimately he's a businessman. He doesn't like losing money. And if Arsenal slip any further, he will start to lose money. And that's when hopefully he'll see sense.
Yeah, change the subject slightly. Keen to get your thoughts on Koscielny. Of course, he hasn't travelled with the team. Looks like he's going to get fined. He's keen to force his way out of Arsenal. How's that gone down?
I would say, other than anger, it's just general disappointment in the fan base, because you are talking about a player who's probably been one of our most consistent performers in the post sort of Highbury era. He had became the club captain. Most people were happy for that. He has been a great servant. In fact, it was only 9 years anniversary of his signing. It was last week, actually, or the week before last. And so it took everyone by surprise. I think the club could have managed it better. But I think we're in a situation, this is a classic example of when you don't have a proper management structure. Mm. You know, somebody who's no longer at the club, or some people who are no longer at the club, we can only assume that to be Ivan Gazidis, possibly Arsene Wenger, have obviously made a verbal commitment to Laurent Koscielny that he could leave, you know, in the last year, or that all that extra year wouldn't be triggered. We don't know exactly what, but obviously the player's saying, I was promised that I could leave, you know, after 9 years' service if I wanted to. And the present management are saying, well, we don't know anything about that. Why on earth would we let a player who's probably worth 5 to 8 million leave for free in the financial situation we're in? And in this instance, you have to sympathise with the club. However much, you know, you like the player, he is a sellable asset. So if he wants to go to France and someone wants to buy him for 5 to 8 million, then he goes with our blessing. It's such a shame in the modern era when you don't see many players able to come back to clubs. I thought he would be one. Mm. You know, we've had so many high-profile players leave Arsenal who aren't welcome back, you know, and the fans don't have much of a taste for that. This was one I thought would actually walk away with his head held high, but sadly not.
Yeah, I mean, and the obvious other one, of course, is Aaron Ramsey, isn't there? He's been unveiled at Juventus on what is believed to be £400,000 a week, which, of course, they can afford to pay him because they haven't really had to pay for him, if that makes sense. So, I mean, that was a little bit of a shock. But what's your take on the Ramsey situation? And is there anyone in particular now? We've spoken a bit about Arsenal foraging away in the transfer market. Is there anyone in particular that you would like to see brought in?
Well, the Aaron Ramsey situation was badly managed. Ultimately, I'm not one of the fans who's crestfallen. I'm crestfallen we didn't get any money for him. I'm not crestfallen he left the club. I mean, he averaged 30 games a season for about the last 6 years. You know, you can't spend £200,000 a week on a player who's only fit for half a season. So that's Juventus's decision to take that risk, and I wish him all the best. He's had some fantastic games for us. He's equally had some very average periods for us. Yeah. With regard to replacement, I think I'm at the stage now, and I think many Arsenal fans, certainly of my age and match gang fans, are at the same point, and last night sort of illustrated why. If we can't afford to win the league or compete to win the league, then as a match game fan, I would be happy to see some of our stellar youngsters given a chance in the team this season.
Yeah.
You know, if you just want to go, enjoy a pint with your friends, enjoy the atmosphere, walk to the ground, the same buzz you get, and be in the stadium and watch your team, then, you know, if you're playing good football and you've got three or four kids who are proud to be playing for the cannon on their chest because they've been there since they were nine, I'm all for that. So in midfield, in Ramsey's role, the sort of, you know, forward box-to-box role, we've got Emil Smith-Rowe and Joe Willock, both who starred at various points in the Europa League last season. So I'm quite excited for that. And if you look at the performance last night, I know we're playing an American MLS side, but they're halfway through their season and we're playing youngsters who haven't kicked a ball for 3 months. And we walked all over them. And some of those performances were, the standouts were Martinelli, we just signed from Brazil. Saka on the left wing was amazing. Oleinko in central midfield was Cesc-like, apparently. So, yeah, there's a lot to be positive on that side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's actually just widening it slightly as well. I think you look at Manchester United, they're going to have to play the kids to an extent. Chelsea obviously are as well. Klopp isn't adverse to throwing some youngsters in. And if Arsenal do the same, I actually think it makes for a really, really exciting Premier League season. The likes of which we've not necessarily seen in terms of youngsters before. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. Always an absolute pleasure to have you on. Dave Seager there from GunnersTown.com and also host of the Arsenal Fan Show. Do you reckon, Rich, if you were an Arsenal fan, that you would lament the day you ever moved out of Highbury and went to the Emirates? Because it's all changed since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, he touched there on the business model. And I think with a lot of clubs, that's what it comes down to now, which it should do, and it has to an extent. But of course, you look at the biggest clubs, the ones that are having the most success, they aren't necessarily following a strict business model whereby they need to make a profit. And I guess that's probably the slight difference where they've built the stadium, eventually they've paid it off. Look, the long-term future of Arsenal, you would think, is very, very positive. But it does just feel like they are pitching fourth place where possible, or aiming for fourth place, as opposed to maybe aiming for the title. But anyway, as always, let us know your thoughts. 0208 70 20 558.
Love Sport.
There is a new holder of the British heavyweight title, and his name is Daniel Dubois. He won the British title and continued his rise towards heavyweights boxing's biggest names with a fifth-round stoppage of rival Nathan Gorman. The 21-year-old Londoner showcased his power at his city's O2 Arena, scoring a knockdown in the third round. Joining us now is boxing journalist Oliver McManus. Good morning, Oliver.
You all right, mate?
Daniel Dynamite Dubois. He made a real statement on Saturday, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And it was, do you know what? It was really impressive how he made a genuine 50-50 look like a one-sided demolition job. Because beforehand, everyone was expecting Nathan Gorman to always be there or thereabouts and certainly see it through to the later rounds where perhaps he might have the better success. But Dubois just didn't let him get settled, and it was a really impressive performance.
How long before he is seriously being mentioned in the same breath as the likes of the Anthony Joshuas of this world?
Well, when he turned professional, he said he wanted to be world champion in 2020 because obviously he was planning on going to the Tokyo Olympics in 2020, and he said, well, actually, if I can become world champion by then as a professional, I'll be happy with that. So I imagine we've got to measure him on sort of his own ambitions, and I feel as though he's certainly equipped to become, if not a world champion, knocking around the door of a world title shot towards the back end of 2020.
Well, that would be good. And it really is a little kind of a golden period, a purple patch, actually, you could say, for British heavyweight boxing at the minute, and probably British boxing in general, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly when you look, even from a sort of a small hall level, you know, every Saturday as opposed to on TV, the amount of young fighters you've got coming through, I've never seen as many before in my life that have got that potential to then go and put that talent onto a TV platform and actually win meaningful titles. They're not just boxing to make up the numbers. So many of them now have got potential to make up, to win titles. And Daniel Dubois, the youngest ever British heavyweight title, he joins the likes of Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua, Lennox Lewis in holding the British heavyweight title, but he might just be the best of the lot.
Someone else who's wanted to challenge the top heavyweights, of course, Dillian White. He faces Oscar Rivas this weekend. Do you expect him to come through that unscathed?
Yes and no. I think Oscar Rivas is one of those guys that he's got such a strong amateur pedigree, you can never write him off. And it almost does him a disservice, but he reminds me of David Price in that he's kind of got a puncher's chance. He's always remaining plucky throughout the 12 rounds. And a bit of news as well, Dillian White versus Oscar Rivas is now for the interim WBC heavyweight world title, which essentially means after the Fury Wilder rematch, which is supposedly taking place in February, White has to challenge for the world title by the end of May 2020. So it's a bit of a long-term plan, but he's in there with a world title shot by the end of May.
Of course, that is interesting. Just on that Fury Wilder thing there, you seem to be a little bit sceptical about whether or not it will actually happen, that rematch.
Oh, I'm always sceptical about everything until a contract's signed. I've been around for far too long within boxing to not trust people.
Right, okay, fantastic, excellent. I mean, I have the same thing with co-hosts on this show, actually. but there we are. Look, just the age-old question, isn't it? Who would actually win in a fight out of, you know, Fury, Wilder and Joshua? I mean, who is the best there, do you think?
Well, I said to you before Fury Wilder first took place that I thought Tyson Fury was the best. And I've got to stick with that after, well, he all but beat Deontay Wilder. We all know he won. Forget the fact it was a draw. But yeah, I stick with Tyson Fury. I think he's the best of the lot. But he's also most likely to have an off night. So.
Yeah, true.
Great stuff, Oliver. Thank you very much. Oliver McManus there, boxing journalist, giving us his thoughts on Dubois' victory and Dillian White as well. Who do you think will win in a boxing match out of me and you?
Me.
Do you genuinely think that?
I do, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I'm quite handy.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that could be fun.
Yeah, well, I thought you and Thomas, actually, who does Love Sport Drive on Friday, he and I were very close to engaging in some fisticuffs for charity.
Okay.
But, you know, it never came to be. Ah. Never came to be. But, no, I would revel in breaking your nose.
Would you really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I wouldn't stop until the police came in either.
Even when they've, you know, I'm down.
I'd come to about, you know, 30 seconds later, not realising what I've done, just looking at my own hands, screaming.
Yeah. What have I done?
Yeah. Oh, why have I done this? Why do I do it to everyone I love, you know?
Yeah. When you just see red for that period of time, it's a really interesting sensation.
Would you like to fight me?
Would I like to fight
you?
There's times when I think it'd be quite enjoyable. Yeah,
really right, enjoyable. Good.
Yeah. Most mornings.
Good-o. Fantastic. Yes.
Excellent. We're going to be moving on very shortly to talk about, conspiracy theories, but talking about the moon landing, of course, which I believe we will have someone on the line very shortly. So I'm quite excited to talk about
that. Right, so look, it's basically 50 years since Apollo 11. Yeah. So since we first set foot on the moon, which was obviously an iconic, historic day. Yeah. But to a lot of people, it was made in a Hollywood studio and never really happened. And so we have got a NASA scientist, or former NASA space scientist, currently editor of Spaceflight magazine. He's published more than 100 books on the moon landing. He's called Dr. David Baker. He's going to be coming on to try and clear up some of your most prominent conspiracy theories about the moon landing. Mm. I'm quite keen, though, because Dr. David Baker doesn't... I don't think he knows too much about the show.
Yeah.
So I think we could pretend to be quite like rabid UFO conspiracy theorists, put on like an American accent, and really just hound him. Why would the flag flutter, David? There's no gravity on the moon. Yeah, why is the shadow pointing the wrong way?
We could do that. We could lose a guest forevermore. And who knows? We may well speak to Dr. David Baker many times in the future. So I suggest we don't do that.
Okay, fine.
Love Sport.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Now, it is the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, where Apollo 11 with astronauts Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins orbited and then landed on the moon, with Armstrong and Aldrin taking the first steps on a rock that wasn't Earth. However, not everybody believes the landings took place. Joining us now to debunk some of those myths is former NASA space scientist and currently editor of Spaceflight magazine, Dr. David Baker. Good morning, Dr. Baker.
Good morning.
Good morning. 50 years since this momentous event. Was it the greatest manned exploration mission ever?
Well, I think it was, yes. It opened the door to a whole range of different missions coming on after that for exploration of the moon. It wasn't just a one-shot wonder. Mm-hmm. A million people watched it live from Cape Canaveral, and what they were seeing was the opening up of a massive expansion of the whole space program.
Well, fantastic. I mean, it was, you know, obviously one of those things. It was, I can remember with like my dad saying to me, my mum said to me, they remember where they were. You know, it's an absolutely iconic thing, and it must have been, especially for the time as well. I mean, it must have been absolutely bonkers, really, to think that we've put some men on the moon. But clearly not everyone has bought into this, Dr. Baker. Some people, as I'm sure you're aware as well as anybody, believe that the whole thing is some kind of elaborate hoax directed by someone like Stanley Kubrick in a Hollywood basement somewhere. Let's just run through why, you know, some of that isn't true, basically. So one of the most common claims about why it was faked is that the flag was flapping. People say that the flag on the moon, when it was put in the earth, shouldn't have been flapping. Should it have been flapping?
Well, obviously it was vibrating against the elastic effect of the pole, the twang effect of the pole. And initially, when you stake it in the ground, it's going to have that vibration as it shudders to a stop. So you can take bits of film here, bits of film there, stitch them together. But I think really little bits of minutiae like that are absolutely buried within the onslaught of evidence that we actually did go. And I think while we could argue forever and ever about, oh, how long should it have been flapping away until all those vibrations had nulled out, until it had settled down, against the fact that this was not some venture that was put together in a secret government military installation. This involved 350,000 people in 2,000 companies, private companies, working, even the very spacecraft and the rockets. They were not built by NASA. They were built by the big aerospace corporations over many, many years. We had observatory sightings as the spacecraft were departing Earth, and we had observatory sightings picking up telescopic vision of the returning spacecraft at the end of the mission. And how you can con 350,000 people and a million spectators into seeing something that's not there, I feel is absolutely unbelievable in itself.
Yeah, well, what I'm trying to, we've actually got an article in front where it is debunking some of the things in the way that you're doing. But one of the other ones was the shadows on the moon itself. I know there was a few question marks as to the shadows.
Yeah. Well, I think you can build an equal agenda on two sides of the argument. There are people who profess to be optical specialists and experts in optical light bounce and reflections on both sides. And I've read papers which are in learned journals, which are purporting to demonstrate that there's something wrong with the angle of the shadows. Then you'll get another expert who comes along and explains it purely logically in the way of reflected light bouncing off various parts of the structure. And I think one of the underpinning reasons on this is that light does not behave in a vacuum in the way that it does when we are looking at things here with the dispersion of the Earth's atmosphere, which is quite dense, and it's quite different. And when you're in a vacuum, you get no light dispersal, but simply a lot of angular reflections coming up in a way that's completely unique. And we're quite used to this because we're looking at pictures which are taken by automatic spacecraft. And even the spacecraft, and this is reverting back to other myth-busting arguments, the fact that we have sent in the last decade spacecraft to the moon with very high-resolution camera images of the actual sites. You can see all the disturbed ground around the lander stage, which is still there for each of the six sites. And also you've got the tracks of the roving vehicles that we put on the last three of the six landings. So light shadows is really, if that's all you've got to go on, you're really down at the bottom of the barrel.
Well, that's actually where I reside. But yes, fantastic. You know, why aren't we going back? Let's just go back. I dream on. I would love to go to space. Honestly, it is a serious bucket list thing. And I hope, I'm 27 now, right? I hope that by the time I'm, I don't know, 50 or 60, dare I say it's 70, I might be able to somehow find myself in space. Please tell me that this is a reality.
Oh, it is a reality, yes. Get Have it. You got your ticket yet?
No, but I will be there.
It's on its way, but I think, you know, why are we going back? Well, obviously the attention of the space program, which has now become very international with the International Space Station, and we've got people from all over the world living and working together on board this facility, from Russia, Japan, from Canada, from Europe and the United States, and certainly that's been the vector and that's been the interest. But remember that for 7 years after the last crew returned from the moon in 1972, we had instruments there which were transmitting scientific data, and this is another myth-busting fact, that for 7 years we had instruments sending information to receiving stations all over the world. This is not just secret government agencies picking up this stuff. This is organizations all over the world, and I had the great good fortune to go to the former Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, to negotiate contracts and deals and cooperative programs with the Russians. They were totally convinced it happened, and they toasted it as a great plus for humanity and for the general progress of space exploration that they were very much a fundamental part of.
Oh, exactly. No, I mean, it is a mind-boggling achievement, really, seriously. And I think I obviously don't remember. I wasn't alive when it happened at the time. It's something I've taken for granted, really, the fact that I just know we sent some people to the moon. But when you really break it down, it's goodness me, I don't quite understand how we actually did it. But a recent YouGov poll has found that 1 in 6 British people agreed with the statement the moon landings were staged. So that says a lot about society, I think, doesn't it? But just on a slightly different thing, just lastly, yep. There's a lot of, as I'm sure you're aware, of Netflix. Netflix is everywhere now, and they are putting a lot behind quite a big documentary, actually, on a chap called Bob Lazar, who claims to have worked at Area 51 and claims that we have, in fact, come into possession of various alien craft and we have been visited by aliens. Do you reckon we've ever been visited by aliens?
I would have to base, and I have a completely open mind. I'm completely open to the possibility that that could have happened. I have been to Area 51, but you only go for a very specific task in and out. It is a very secret government research establishment doing activities in lots of areas. I have a completely open mind. It's not the scientific method to button everything down and say yes or no. We have to keep an open mind on things until facts prove one direction or another. So I am completely open to the possibility. I have yet to see evidence which shifts me to believe that we actually have. But as far as I'm concerned, it's a work in progress.
Fantastic. Love it. Thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Aww. Dr. David Baker, former NASA space scientist and currently editor of Space Flight Magazine with more than 100 books published.
I think, you see, this is it, right? And you know when you go, oh, I don't think the world would be ready. People aren't ready. We'd freak out if we found out we've been visited by aliens or if whatever happened. The reality is, more and more often now, you have people like this guy, a NASA scientist, saying, yeah, we might have been.
Yeah. Love Sport. Retired Australian umpire Simon Torfell, who was named the International Cricket Council's Umpire of the Year on 5 successive occasions from 2004 to 2008, said the decision to award England 6 for overthrows after a ball hit Ben Stokes whilst he was trying to make his ground for an incorrect decision was an incorrect decision. Joining us now is Kelvin McKenzie, former editor of the Sun newspaper. Morning, Kelvin.
Morning.
Good morning. I believe you've got quite strong feelings about this.
Yes. I mean, my view is that we have won this cup under extraordinary circumstances. We didn't make the mistake. The England cricket team didn't make the mistake. The New Zealand cricket team didn't make the mistake. But a mistake was made of catastrophic proportions. If you were the New Zealand team that had spent 8 weeks in our country as our guests, to be effectively robbed. And this is my solution. My solution is that we actually share the cup. We simply say, and this is where I agree with the coach of New Zealand, who said his name's Gary Stead, he suggested the trophy may have been shared. He said, when you play over a 7-week period and it can't be separated, that should be considered. You know, and that is, this is an offer, a hand of friendship to somebody. Now, I might not have felt the same way towards Australia if it had happened in the Ashes, but I definitely felt that this was such a dramatic game that we should do it. And where, by the way, I disagree with your excellent news correspondent, I think his name is Paris, I'm not entirely sure. He was saying that the expression, so if you read Cricket Law 19.8 out, if the boundary results from an overthrow or from the willful act of a fielder, the run scored shall be any runs for penalties awarded to either side, and the allowance for the boundary and the runs completed by the batsman, together with the run in progress, if they had already crossed at the instance of the throw or act. Now, the point that Paris was trying to make was by using the word act, that could mean anything. No, it doesn't mean it. It refers back to what had been said earlier about a willful act. I don't know what the willful act might be. Could it be the fielder trying to destroy the ball or deliberately throwing it over the line or something like that? No, it's quite clear the run had not been completed. And my point really is not so much about the law. The law is there. The umpires and everybody in the crowd, by the way, so however many, 22,000 odd people there, they all got it wrong as well. Nobody got it wrong. This guy sits on the Marylebone Cricket Club's subcommittee on the rules, so nobody knows this stuff better than he does. And yes, mistakes do happen, but the mistake in this case was so incredible that I think we should extend our hand of friendship 12,000 miles. When you looked at the expression on the you know, they hadn't, a black cat hadn't just crossed, they're called the black cats, it's amazing, hadn't just crossed the path of the New Zealand cricket team, it had actually turned round and bitten their leg. I mean, the guy caught the catch, he stepped on the boundary rope, that was the end of that. The biggest freak ever.
Yeah, but you know,
in cricket happened when that ball hit Ben Stokes's bat. So anyway, I've contacted Ben Stokes's agent and I've offered them £5,000 for that bat. That bat is going to be the number one sporting icon in the world, right? Within a year, 18 months. I mean, Ben Stokes himself has completely changed his attitude. One minute he's supposed to be, I think as you pointed out, Patrick, supposed to be a rather nasty piece of work involved in a punch-up outside a pub and clearly drinking too much. Today he is a national hero. So this, Patrick, is something for you to look at. You look at Ben Stokes and say, every morning, how can I be more like Ben Stokes? Not like I was last night when I was out on the sherbet with Rich.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, this has been a lovely end to a wonderful evening, actually, for yeah. Rich and I. But look, you know, Diego Maradona, right, the hand of God. What about Frank Lampard in the South Africa Football World Cup, where the Germans, you know, Frank Lampard shoots from outside the box, it goes in. There was no talk then of them sharing anything with us. Why should we be doing it now, Calvin?
Because we are bigger than they are. We are decent people. The fair play is a DNA that runs through our body. And we should be bigger from it and say, under all these extraordinary circumstances that affected New Zealand, right at the end, the worst of them all, they were given, we were given a run to which we weren't, an actual run, a run, not about a wicket, not about a catch, but an actual run to which we weren't invited. We have to be bigger than anybody else. And you say, New Zealand, we love you and we don't want to see you upset, and we will be happy as joyous by sharing. I mean, we are all God's people, Patrick. You know that.
I think we've tapped into something quite important here, Calvin, because in the post-Brexit world, right, diplomatically, we need all the friends that we can get. We need leverage in trade deals. Now, New Zealand could be a useful ally in that. So could the Aussies.
Well, I tell you what, you're quite right, because when we went to the EU and we said no to the Commonwealth, there were trading barriers, which meant we couldn't have New Zealand lamb. Do you remember all that?
Yes.
We couldn't take New Zealand lamb, and we sentenced a whole load of people we didn't even know to penury. This is our opportunity to say sorry about the lamb, sorry about the Commonwealth, welcome back into the fold. They need us more than we need them. Let's do the decent thing. Patrick, get aboard.
Okay, all right, Calvin, fantastic. Look, just while we've got you on, because I think this is going to gather serious traction, the idea that maybe we should share the World Cup with the Kiwis. But you've said a lot about them, and that's fantastic. What do you make of England's cricketing heroes there?
Oh, yeah. No, that was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And I shared, and everybody I know was watching about three different devices, right, during the sport yesterday. So my mate, he's an accountant, we won't hold that against him, he was sitting there watching the cricket and had the tennis on the laptop, you know. And actually the numbers were very similar. I don't know about you, I can listen to it. So I tell you what, I've had the injection now. I was listening to Five Live last night. You remember that, BBC, the thing you pay for? It's a form of pay radio. It's a good idea. I was thinking of starting it for Love Sport. Anyway, the old pay radio guys that we're doing each of the balls and then analysing afterwards. It was compelling. I then went and watched last night. It's the advantage, by the way, of being single. It's one of the reasons why the former holders of the office left me. Actually, I was then watched both Sky. I watched Sky's best bits, you know. So it's one of those games with such an astonishing ending that we will be talking about it, watching it, discussing it for years on end. And you just think of the sporting question which will emerge out of all this, which will catch everybody out at pub quizzes and TV shows forever and a day, which will be, under what circumstances was 4 runs scored in an international cricket match, in which the bowler didn't bowl and the batsman didn't hit it, right? You know, honestly, it'll be fantastic forever and a day.
Apparently, Ben Stokes tried to ask the umpires to take the runs off. So this is something that's come off our New Zealand cricket correspondent.
Seriously?
Yeah, so just have a quick listen to this. We've got some audio of this loaded up.
I ran into a good friend of mine who's relatively close to the team, and he said that one of the Black Caps players had told him that Ben Stokes had actually asked the umpires to take those runs back from the overthrows, but they said they couldn't because it's in the rule book. And, you know, I don't know how much he pushed it, but I think he was just so, you know, he felt like that's a pretty harsh way for them to get those crucial runs. And yeah, that was what I was told the other night, that Stokes actually said to them, is there any way that we can take those runs back?
Ben Stokes' redemption is complete, I think, Calvin.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think you referred to it earlier, that the amount of money that Ben Stokes will now make. I mean, to be honest, he doesn't really need the money in the same way, for instance, that you do, and particularly Rich does with some of his balmy commercial ideas, but, as a form of investment. But he's one of the great. He's one of the one-day players of the world. But the other thing that emerges is that 50-over cricket is likely to die, you know, because what's happening is that every ounce of ECB marketing next year and all the sign-ups are going to go to the 100 ball game. Mm-hmm. And it'd be very interesting to see who will play. I'm not even sure that anybody will be playing 50-over cricket. So we're going to be world champions of a game which, in England, that we aren't going to be playing very much as of next year. It's an extraordinary moment.
Yeah, it really is. Kelvin, as always, thank you very much. Kelvin McKenzie there, former editor of the Sun newspaper.
Oh, what a man.
Indeed, indeed. Some interesting thoughts.
A lot of interesting thoughts. A lot of thoughts. Yeah, definitely. I can see where he's coming from. I can see it as for purely diplomatic purposes in this post-Brexit world that we now live in, or are soon to live in. Maybe we could just, you know, curry favour with people around the world by just being nice to them and just kind of rolling over and admitting defeat on major international sporting events.
That could be the way forward.
The
fact that Ben Stokes actually did offer, apparently, to give the... I mean, that's big, by the way, that he has actually said, look, that's not a fair way for us to do this. That's actually a massive statement.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.